Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again and welcome back. This is the program that tells you about important events from around the world. And we speak at a slower speed. That's a good thing if you're trying to learn American English. Today we have two serious stories for you. The first is about an increase in executions in Saudi Arabia. The question is, why? Or why now? Then the United Nations speaks out in support of journalists who work in dangerous places. Reporting the news is not as safe as it once was. Let's get started with today's program. Human rights groups are reporting an increase in the number of executions in Saudi Arabia. Saudi executions are usually beheadings, where the prisoner is killed in a public place. Some observers say the increase could be a show of force by the government. They say Saudi officials are seeking to keep the kingdom safe from a security crisis in other countries. Bob Doty joins us with more.
Last week, Saudi Arabia executed its 89th prisoner this year. That is almost equal to the number killed in all of 2014. Adam Kugel studies Middle East issues for Human Rights Watch. He says Saudi officials have given no reason for the increase.
Saudi Arabian authorities do not comment publicly on this issue other than to say that under Islamic law it's their right to carry out executions. Because they don't release information, we really don't know for sure why there's been such a rise in the number of those executions over the last, really, 8 to 9 months.
The rise in executions began last August after Islamic State militants launched attacks on communities in Iraq and Syria. The militant group, also known as ISIS, gained control of large areas with surprising speed. Savag Keshishan is a Saudi Arabia expert with the rights group Amnesty International. He says the increased number of executions may be a product of unrest in the area.
These theories say that the reason why the Saudi authorities have been carrying out executions at such a rate is because they want to signal to ISIS, to others in the region, that they are quite in charge or in control of what's going on inside the country and that they will punish transgressions extremely harshly. So it's sort of a show of power.
There are competing theories to explain the increase, he adds, like increased efficiency in the judiciary. Most executions are carried out in public spaces, and the condemned are beheaded. Sometimes the bodies are left lying in the open. 22 countries permit execution as a form of punishment. Saudi Arabia is often on the list of the top 5 countries that perform the most executions. The other 4 are China, Iran, Iraq, and the United States. Adam Kugel of Human Rights Watch says there is strong evidence that Saudi courts do not meet international norms for fair trials.
Some people allege that they were coerced into confessing. Some people claim they had difficulty accessing lawyers. One of the big issues is defendants not initially knowing the charges against them until after they're actually brought before a judge.
He adds that nearly half of all executions in Saudi Arabia are for crimes related to drug trafficking. And he says some people are executed for other nonviolent crimes, like having sex with someone other than your husband or wife. Last year, Shia Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr was sentenced to death. The sentence was announced after he was accused of disobeying the ruler and inciting religious violence. He also was accused of supporting and leading demonstrations. His case fueled protests around the world. If al-Nimr is executed, tensions could increase between Sunni and Shiite Muslims in Saudi Arabia and other countries. But a Kuwait-based observer, Haider Ghatanfari, thinks the execution is unlikely. He notes recent Saudi efforts to reach out to the country's Shia minority. Amnesty's Savag Keshishan says the possibility for political unrest could delay or cancel the execution. He claims that al-Nimr's trial had a political motive and lacked strong evidence. Even so, some officials appear ready to carry out the sentence. I'm Bob Doty.
You are listening to the Voice of America from Washington. The United Nations Security Council has approved a resolution on the protection of journalists in conflict zones. All 15 council members voted last week in support of the resolution. The measure comes as the number of deaths and kidnappings of news reporters and other media workers continues to rise.
The group Reporters Without Borders says 66 journalists were killed last year, and more than 20 others have died since January. Over the past 10 years, 700 media workers have been killed, either while on the job or because of their occupation. The UN resolution condemns such attacks. It warns those involved in conflicts, including governments and armed groups, to take all reasonable steps to protect journalists. It also calls for the immediate and unconditional release of reporters who are held as hostages in battle areas. Christophe Deloire works for Reporters Without Borders. He said, "Iraq and Syria have become two of the most dangerous places for journalists to work. 45 have been killed in Syria since that conflict started in 2011. In Iraq, at least 15 others have died since 2013. Mr. Deloire said, "Ensuring accountability is important to preventing future attacks."
In the world, more than 90% of the crimes against journalists are never prosecuted, are never punished. It's like an encouragement for all those who commit crimes against journalists. So if we want to protect journalists, we have to fight impunity.
He added that attacks on journalists in conflict areas could be considered war crimes and should be given to the International Criminal Court. The United States ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, is a former journalist. She says restrictions on press freedom and threats against reporters often are signs of an effort to suppress civil, political, and human rights. She noted the current political unrest in the Central African nation of Burundi. There, the country's military disputed President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to seek a third term in office. Many people in Burundi consider a third term unconstitutional.
Since the unlawful attempt to seize power was quashed, several independent journalists report being told that they are on a list of people to be arrested, and many more reportedly have been threatened with death, torture, and disappearance, leading them to go into hiding.
Ms. Power said, "Governments like the one in Syria and armed groups, such as the Islamic State, attack journalists because they do not want people to see them for what they really are." As the Security Council met Wednesday, the Committee to Protect Journalists released a statement condemning the murder of a Brazilian radio reporter. His tortured body was found last Saturday, one day after he was reported kidnapped in the country's northeast. it was the second murder of a Brazilian journalist in less than a week.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America. We are coming to you from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. We all know that exercise is good for your health, but some kinds of exercise may be better than others. Running, for example, may help to protect against heart disease and other health problems. Running may also help you live longer. Researchers say it is not important how far you run. It also does not matter how fast or even how often you run. As advertisements for the running shoe Nike say, just do it. Recently, researchers studied more than 55,000 adults. About one-fourth of the adults reported running regularly. The study found these runners were considerably less likely than non-runners to die of any form of disease, including heart disease. In fact, the runners lived, on average, 3 years longer than the non-runners. This study lasted 15 years. During that time, more than 3,400 of the individuals died. About 1,200 of the deaths were linked to heart disease, a heart attack, or stroke. One of the researchers is a man named D.C. Lee. He is an assistant professor of kinesiology, or the science of movement, at Iowa State University. Compared to non-runners, he says, runners showed a much lower risk of dying from some diseases.
Compared to non-runners, runners showed a 30% lower risk of death by any causes, including heart attack, stroke, or cancer. Also, runners compared to non-runners showed 45% lower risk of death by cardiovascular disease, including heart attack and stroke.
D.C. Lee and the other researchers found that speed, distance, and how often one runs made little difference in reducing the risk of death. The runners in the study averaged between 10 and 16 kilometers per hour. Mr. Lee says slower runners and those who only ran once or twice a week were helped nearly as much as those who ran faster and further.
And also we look at the running over time, and we found that persistent runners over, I think, 6 years, they showed the biggest benefits as well.
To stay healthy, doctors suggest that adults up to age 65 do 150 minutes of moderate exercise every week. They say these individuals need 75 minutes of vigorous exercise, like running, every week for good health. The researchers note that their study was based on the participants answering questions over the years. The study lacked complete information on what these men and women ate and other facts about their lifestyles. Researchers say this missing information could have affected the results. Still, they hope their findings will motivate healthy adults to start running a bit down the road to a longer life. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we continue the story of America's 33rd president, Harry Truman. Truman was sometimes called an accidental president. He only became president because he was vice president when Franklin Roosevelt died in 1945. In the election of 1948, Truman ran for a full term. As we told you last week, many experts predicted he would lose. But voters chose him over the Republican Party candidate, Thomas E. Dewey, the governor of New York. Americans also elected a Congress with a majority from Truman's Democratic Party. The president might have expected a Congress led by his own party to support his policies, but that did not always happen. Time after time, Democrats from southern states joined in voting with conservative Republicans. Together, these lawmakers defeated some of Truman's most important proposals. One of the defeated bills was a proposal for health care insurance for every American. One of the major issues during Truman's second term was fear of communism. After World War II, Americans watched as one Eastern European nation after another became an ally of the Soviet Union. Soviet leader Joseph Stalin wanted to see communism spread around the world. And Americans watched as China became communist in 1949, as forces led by Mao Zedong defeated the Chinese nationalists after a civil war that had lasted more than 10 years. During this tense period, there were charges that communists held important jobs in the United States government. These fears, real or imagined, became known as the Red Scare.
Even if there were only one communist in the State Department, that would still be one communist too many.
A Republican senator from Wisconsin, Joseph McCarthy, led the search for communists in America. In speeches and congressional hearings, he accused hundreds of people of being communists or communist supporters. His targets included the State Department, the Army, and the entertainment industry. Senator McCarthy often had little evidence to support his accusations. Many of his charges would not have been accepted in a court of law. But the rules governing congressional hearings were different, so he was able to make his accusations freely. Many people lost their jobs after they were denounced as communists. Some had to use false names to get work. A few went to jail briefly for refusing to cooperate with McCarthy. The senator continued his anti-communist investigations for several years. By the early 1950s, however, more people began to question his methods. Critics said he violated democratic traditions. In 1954, the Senate finally voted to condemn his actions. McCarthy died 3 years later. There were problems caused by the fear of communists at home. But President Truman also had to deal with the threat of communism in other countries. He agreed to send American aid to Greece and Turkey. He also supported continuing the Marshall Plan. That was the huge economic aid program that helped rebuild Western Europe after World War II. Many historians say the Marshall Plan prevented Western Europe from becoming communist. The defense of Western Europe against Soviet communism led Truman to support the creation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. NATO began in 1949 with the United States, Britain, Canada, France, and 8 other nations. The treaty that created NATO stated that a military attack on any member would be considered an attack on all of them. Truman named General Dwight Eisenhower to command the new organization. General Eisenhower had been supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe in World War II. In his swearing-in speech in 1949, Truman urged the United States to lend money to other countries to aid their development. He also wanted to share American science and technology. In 1951, the president asked Congress to establish a new foreign aid program. The aid would go to countries threatened by communist forces in Europe, the Middle East, North Africa, East Asia, South Asia, and Latin America. Truman believed the United States would be stronger if its allies were stronger. President Truman believed that many of the world's problems could be settled by means other than military force, but he supported and used military power throughout his presidency. On June 25, 1950, forces from North Korea invaded South Korea. 2 days later, the United Nations Security Council approved a resolution urging UN members to help South Korea resist the invasion. At first, President Truman agreed to send American planes and ships. Later, he agreed to send American ground forces. The president knew his decision could start World War III if the Soviet Union entered the war on the side of communist North Korea. Yet he felt the United States had to act. Later, he said it was the most difficult decision he made as president. Truman named Army General Douglas MacArthur to command all United Nations forces in South Korea. Most of the fighting in the Korean War took place along the geographic line known as the 38th parallel. This line formed the border between North and South Korea. Many victories on the battlefield were only temporary. One side would capture a hill, then the other side would recapture it. In September of 1950, MacArthur led the UN land and sea attack at Incheon, pushing the North Koreans back across the border. There was hope that the war could end by Christmas, December 25th. In late November, however, troops from China joined the North Koreans. Thousands of Chinese soldiers helped push the UN troops south. General MacArthur wanted to attack Chinese bases in Manchuria. President Truman said no. He did not want the fighting to spread beyond the Korean Peninsula. Again, he feared that such a decision could start another world war. MacArthur strongly believed he could end the war quickly by extending it to the Chinese mainland. He publicly denounced Truman's policy, saying, "There is no substitute for victory." Truman felt that the general left him no choice. In April of 1951, he dismissed MacArthur.
"It was with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders, but the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual.
In the United States, military leaders are expected to obey their commander-in-chief, the president. While some Americans approved of the general's dismissal, many others supported MacArthur. Millions greeted him when he returned to the United States. There were huge parades in his honor in San Francisco and New York. In fact, few leaders in the 20th century could boast the support MacArthur had. Almost 7 million people attended the ticker tape parade given to him by New York City. And that almost doubled the size of the one given to another returning World War II hero, General Dwight Eisenhower. MacArthur gave his farewell speech to a joint session of Congress on April 19, 1951.
I am closing my 52 years of military service. When I joined the Army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plane at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye.
On the Korean Peninsula, the war continued. Ceasefire talks began in July of 1951, but the conflict would last for another 2 years until a truce was declared. The Korean War Armistice Agreement was signed on July 27, 1953. ...1952 was a presidential election year in the United States. Harry Truman was losing popularity because of the continuing war in Korea and economic problems at home. At the same time, Dwight Eisenhower, a military hero from World War II, was thinking of running for president as the Republican candidate. Harry Truman had made many difficult decisions as president. In March of 1952, he made one more. He announced that he would not be a candidate for re-election. The 1952 presidential election will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ender, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.